Hi guys,
welcome back
to the Flick Chicks podcast.
I'm Jane
and I'm Allison.
How are you, Allison?
I'm good. It's spring break / summer break because the coronavirus has made everything online.
Yes. It's been an interesting couple of days.
It's been kind of chaotic.
Yeah. So much happened the other day that at the end of the day I was just like, did any of this really happen?
I just kept, okay, so Jane and I both work in a library. I know what you're thinking. Do you guys ever stop seeing each other? No.
Nope.
We work in the same library.
Yes, on different floors.
Yeah. One floor apart.
And
so, I came in, we both work on Fridays, mm-hmm. So today is a Saturday. So we're recording this on a Saturday, the day before it comes out. And we basically, we're both working, and I was just, the whole day, I was like, is this real? There was nobody there.
No.
It was, completely empty all day. It felt so weird.
It felt so weird. The whole campus, this is right after the campus had said, we're going to close down until May.
Yeah.
Because of the coronavirus. So, basically, the second half of our senior last semester is gone.
Yeah. And they just canceled everything. All college sports are now canceled. Mm-hmm. All ensemble things, so choir, band, shows, all of it is canceled. So, sad. Weird.
Very weird.
But we're still getting paid even though we're not working.
So, it's okay.
Which was good.
Yes.
I was like, thank God, because I would be in a bad place.
Would not be good.
No. But we're still going to be making money even though we can't work. So, thank goodness.
Thank goodness.
They knew the student workers would literally riot.
Yes.
Hey, there's enough of us. They were scared. But this week was our 1 year podcast anniversary.
Yep, on Tuesday.
So we decided to re-record our first ever episode,
which is over Hereditary.
Yes, so you might have noticed that the title of this, you may have already listened to this episode. But if you did listen to that episode, what you'll know is that it's really, really bad. Not bad in the content, but
we made some good points, but it's terrible to listen to.
It's horrible to listen to.
This is a new episode with the same content, but with better audio.
Exactly. And a little bit more of an updated perspective, right? We've been doing this for a year now.
Yeah, and we've seen a lot of other movies. We've seen Ari Aster's other movie now.
And we've noticed more things, upon watching it. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is definitely, to me, one of those movies that you notice things every single time you watch it.
Oh, yeah, certainly.
So, I noticed a lot more.
Yeah, definitely.
Than what I did.
And we watched the deleted scenes.
Yes, which were mostly just, we probably won't talk about many of them because, truly, they were right to be deleted.
Yes, yeah, they weren't bad.
They weren't bad, but they didn't really add anything either.
No, there was one that was a lot.
Yeah, there was one that I was like, ooh, kind of wish that had been left.
Yeah, because I cried. It was a lot.
It was bad. But I guess let's jump in.
So today we're talking about the 2018 horror film Hereditary, starring Toni Collette and Millie Shapiro and Alex Wolff and Gabriel Byrne.
Yes.
And also Ann Dowd.
Yes. This is Ari Aster's directorial debut.
What a directorial debut it is.
Honestly. He does have another film out now, which we've covered as well, Midsommar.
Mm-hmm.
Came out in 2019.
Yep.
And it's also really, really good.
Very different, but very, very good.
Yes, he's definitely a good director.
Yes.
So
he's 2 for 2 now.
He's 2 for 2. And, beyond my expectations, 2 for 2.
Yes.
This movie, Jane and I saw it when it came out.
Like, the week after it came out or something.
Yeah, we both cried in the theater.
Almost peed our pants. This was one of the movies that I almost peed my pants in.
I'm not gonna lie. Yeah, almost peed my pants. I was literally about to cry.
I was so on edge.
Oh, basically, my God. Okay, obviously, I shouldn't have to say this, but I always like to throw it in. Spoiler alert for everything. Everything's gonna be spoiled, okay? If you haven't seen this movie, I don't know what you're doing, but also,
why are you even listening to this podcast?
Stop listening. Okay, here's your last warning. Stop listening to this episode if you haven't seen the movie. Go watch the movie. You're all quarantined for the coronavirus anyway.
You have no excuse.
It's great. So, after Charlie's head is ripped off.
Yeah.
That was the moment where I started to almost cry, and then it just never ended.
No, it doesn't stop. It goes full throttle from that moment on.
Ari Aster, in every one of his movies, the two that he's done, I almost, like, hyperventilate the whole time. I'm on the verge of just hyperventilating.
Yeah, and you come out of the theater and your whole body just aches from just being so tense the entire time.
This is honestly one of my favorite memories with Jame, although it's kind of messed up. After we saw this movie.
Yes.
We came out of the theater. We didn't say anything to each other. We got in the car. We drove all the way home in complete silence. We went up the stairs to our apartment, closed the door, and then I was like, that was fucked up. She was like, yeah. And that was basically it.
And then we went into separate rooms and did research on the film.
And then later, we both were like, did you know? And he was like, I did know. Yeah, so this was quite the experience.
Yeah, the first time you see this movie, you're not going to forget it.
Yeah, you might know this about us, but Jane and I talk a lot. And the idea that a movie could make us shut up for more than 5 minutes really says something about the movie.
definitely.
Because we never watch movies and then don't talk about it.
Yeah. No, it took a long time for us to bounce back from the ending.
I had to process for a while. Like a full 24 hours. I had to go through a sleep cycle where my brain could process that information subconsciously through my dreams.
Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. Okay, so directed and written by Ari Aster. Right. This film is a family tragedy that basically just kind of spirals out of control into this weird supernatural blood fest.
Yeah, and something I really, really love about this movie, I mean, it's no secret that Jane and I, we like slow burn horror.
Yes.
We like horror that has plot beyond, like, a scary thing is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, this movie is, like, all... It is that.
Yeah.
It is completely 100% could stand alone as its own film.
Yes.
You could take out the supernatural elements, and this movie would almost... And you could just make it, like, and he's doing it, and it would be, like, this movie stands alone.
Yeah, it could be just a family tragedy psychological thriller.
Exactly.
If you took out the supernatural elements of it.
But you add the supernatural elements, and then that horrible grief and tension just carries through the whole movie.
Yeah.
And it makes to me, the supernatural stuff way scarier.
I agree.
Especially because, and we watch these, like sort of a director's commentary on this.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have the DVD with the special features or whatever. And Ari Aster said, like, he always feels like horror movies are way scarier when you care about the people.
Yeah, and so he sets up the entire first half of the film just getting to know the characters.
Yeah.
And understanding them and understanding what they're going through. And exactly. I think that even from the very first shot, which is Ellen, her obituary,
mm-hmm.
Annie's mother. And I think that just from the very beginning, you know, like, what kind of
movie this is.
This is.
Agreed. Because, first of all, if the first thing you have to do is read.
Yeah. And it's long.
And it's not like the Star Wars screen crawl, which I hate. But it's not like, here's some information. It's like, this is an obituary. You don't really need to, like, read it to get what's happening.
Yeah.
But you should read it, because there's interesting stuff in there.
Yeah, there is. And it's kind of a precursor to how you view the characters in the film.
It just automatically tells you, like, this is a movie where you're gonna have to pay attention.
Yes, they never try to fool you on that.
This is not a movie where you can be on your phone. And we've talked about this a lot, and we talked about it the first time we recorded this, I think, but that people who don't like this movie, the only reason they can ever give me is that they think it's, like, boring or that it's slow.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think it's slow at all.
No, we were watching this for, I don't know how many times I've seen this movie, a lot. But
it ruins my day every time we have to watch it.
Oh, yeah, me too. But the entire time we were like, how do people think this is slow or boring?
I think it's just, but here's what I think it is. This movie, there's not, like, there's a lot of scenes that just happen in silence. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of scenes where you just literally have to watch, and it's like, things happen that aren't conveyed by dialogue. Things don't happen again and again. You'll notice, like, a lot of horror movies, or just a lot of movies in general, that are not, like, let's say, slow-paced. They're, like, very quick-paced.
Mm-hmm.
They they have a very small amount of information that they'll just repeat over and over and over again because they want to make sure that you catch it.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, this is sort of weird, but in Shakespeare plays, you'll notice that important information is always repeated three times so that Shakespeare could have an actor standing every which way of the stage because the globe is like, it's an arena, but it's sort of like a thrust. So they would say it to the left, they'd say it center, and they'd say it to the right. So that way every single person would hear it. And if you didn't hear it the first time, you would hopefully hear it the second or the third.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So I think, but this is like a thing that, in my opinion, carries a lot over to movies. Like, of course, that was more of a practical aspect. You couldn't hear it. But now it's more like our attention spans are short.
Yes.
And so you need to repeat information that you want to get across. Mm-hmm. But this movie does not do that.
No.
This movie pretty much says something one time, and if you didn't get it, that is too bad.
You are finding things out as the characters are finding things out. An article in Vulture said, I just really liked this quote. It is the film is about a long-lived possession ritual that is seen from the perspective of the sacrificial lambs. That's what Ari Aster said. So I thought that's very interesting because you are experiencing all this grief and heartbreak as the characters are experiencing it.
Yeah.
And even in the first scene, whenever you're there, they're at Ellen's funeral, and you have no idea like who Ellen was or anything like that, only from the obituary, but you're just being thrown into this situation and understanding what all these characters are doing in this horrible time in their lives.
Yeah, and I mean, just from the very beginning, you start and you're automatically like, ooh, this is not a great fam.
No, the eulogy that she gives, you're like, oh.
They were not close.
No. So, I guess, do you want to, like, go through the plot a little bit?
I can read the... Let me get the Wikipedia synopsis up. Another thing we've learned is that we are not that good at telling plots.
It's true. But it does begin with Ellen's funeral.
Yeah.
That is the opening. And it's the Graham family. So we have Annie, Peter, Charlie, and Steve.
So the plot... Annie Graham is a miniatures artist, she makes multiple, who lives in Utah with her husband Steve, their 16-year-old son Peter, and their eccentric and reserved 13-year-old daughter Charlie. At the funeral of her secretive mother, Ellen Lee, Annie delivers a eulogy explaining their fraught relationship and her mother's extremely private life. A week later, Steve is informed that Ellen's grave has been desecrated, while Annie thinks she sees an apparition of Ellen in her workshop. At a support group for the bereaved, Annie reveals that the rest of her family suffered from mental illness and that resulted in their deaths and how Ellen was a significant figure in raising Charlie. So,
Annie's life, not good.
I believe her father starved himself to death.
Yes. With no further information.
No further information on that. And her brother...
Hung himself because she said he had schizophrenia, but he said that his mom was trying to put people inside of him.
Yeah.
So he killed himself when he was like 16.
Yes.
And then her mother wanted to really be there for Annie whenever she was pregnant with Peter, but Annie was like, no, I don't want you around. I'm going to set some boundaries. And so she raised Peter away from Ellen. And then whenever she got pregnant with Charlie, Ellen like pressured her into letting her be a part of Charlie's life, and Ellen wanted Charlie to be a boy for reasons we will find out
later. Also, Annie says her mom at the end had dementia and DID.
Yes, dissociative identity disorder.
Yes.
So multiple personality disorder.
Yeah, yeah. So she says that her mom wasn't altogether there at the end. So from what we know at the beginning, we think Annie's family has a severe history of mental illness.
Yeah.
Which, you know, at first could explain
what's going on with Annie.
So then, to attend a party, Peter lies that he is going to a school event, and Annie forces him to take Charlie with him.
Oof, that scene whenever, it's so awkward whenever he's saying, hey, I'm going to go to the party, and she's, like, questioning him.
I know, and he's like, she's like, well, are you going to drink? And he's like, we're not even old enough to get drinks. And she's like, well, that's a load. Are you going to drink? And he was like, no. I just said no.
Yeah.
The way they talk to each other is so, like, petty.
Yeah, they do not get along, and we'll also talk about that in a little bit. We figured that out later.
So, unsupervised at the party, Charlie eats a cake containing nuts, which she is allergic to, and falls into anaphylactic shock.
Ugh.
As Peter drives her to a hospital, Charlie leans out of the window for air. Peter swerves to avoid a dead deer, and Charlie is decapitated by a telephone pole. In shock, Peter silently drives home and leaves his sister's corpse in the car for their mother to discover the next morning.
Which is the most harrowing scene.
This is the scene in which the tears started to brim the eyes and they never stopped.
So, basically, I'm gonna go through, like, what I feel about these scenes. Mm-hmm. The scene whenever, right after Charlie's head gets ripped off, right. And, Peter is looking in, he's about to look in the rearview mirror, but he can't, and he's crying and hyperventilating, and then he just drives home and lays in bed, and then you're just waiting.
Because
you know that she's gonna find the body, but you're just waiting for her to find the body.
And then she does.
And then it cuts to that scene.
It shows you the head.
It shows you the head with, like, ants crawling all over it.
You're not gonna see the head.
But you see the head.
But you're wrong. Okay. Ew. So,
And they stay on it for so long, so you guys.
So long. The family grieves following Charlie's funeral, heightening tensions between Annie and Peter, and causing Annie to behave coldly towards Steve. Peter is plagued by Charlie's presence around the house. Annie is befriended by a support group member, Joan. Annie tells her she used to sleepwalk and recounts an incident in which she woke up in Peter's bedroom to find herself, Peter, and Charlie covered in paint thinner with a lit match in her hand.
So this is why Peter and Annie don't get along, because Peter doesn't trust her.
Yeah, because she tried to
kill them, basically.
Yeah, in her sleep.
Yeah.
But still. Joan teaches Annie to perform a seance to communicate with Charlie. I have to yawn. All right, we're back.
So subtle.
Annie convinces her family to attempt the seance. Objects begin to move and break, terrifying Peter, and Charlie seemingly possesses Annie until Steve douses her with water. Annie suspects that Charlie's spirit has become malevolent. She throws Charlie's sketchbook into the fireplace, but her sleeve also begins to burn. She retrieves it and heads to Joan's apartment for advice, but Joan is nowhere to be found. Annie notices that Joan's welcome mat resembles her mother's craft work.
Mm-hmm.
She goes through her mother's possessions and finds a photo album linking Joan to Ellen and a book with information about a demon named Payman, who wishes to inhabit the body of a male host. In the attic, Annie finds Ellen's decapitated body with strange symbols on the wall written in blood. At school, Peter slams his head against the desk, breaking his nose, and is brought home.
Oh, that's such an intense scene.
Yes, it is. Very weird. Annie shows Steve her mother's body and the sketchbook. Annie begs Steve to burn the sketchbook so she can sacrifice herself to stop the haunting, but Steve assumes she has gone mad, accusing her of desecrating Ellen's grave herself. When Annie throws the book into the fireplace, Steve bursts into flames and an ethereal light goes into Annie, possessing her. End Act 2.
End Act 2.
Peter awakens to find his father's body. A possessed Annie then chases him into the attic. This is where things really start to go full force, 100%, no stop.
No, yeah, the gas pedal is hitting the floor.
You have a bug on your shoulder.
Whoa.
Killed.
Just like Peter's about to be.
Scary. So, Annie chases him into the attic, which is decorated with occult... I can't stop yawning, I hate myself. Decorated with occult imagery. Levitating, Annie beheads herself with a piano wire as naked coven members look on. Ari Aster is a huge fan of naked old people.
He really, really is.
Peter jumps out of the window.
I love that scene.
This is a very interesting scene because... So all the music is so tense. It's just been tense, tense, tense.
Yes.
Scary, scary music. Then, literally, you see the naked cult members.
And then it stops.
Then all the music cuts out. Peter goes... Ah! And jumps out the window.
Yeah, just runs and jumps out the window and thud.
Lands. And thud. And then that's it. And music. Music is over this whole time. It's just silent.
And then the Donnie Darko light comes back.
As he lies on the ground, a light enters his body and he wakes up. He follows Annie's levitating corpse into Charlie's treehouse, where Charlie's crowned, severed head rests atop a mannequin. Joan, other coven members, and the headless corpses of his mother and grandmother bow to him. Joan, addressing him as Charlie, swears an oath to him as Paimon, stating that he has been liberated from his female host and is free to rule over them. The Coven members bow to Paimon in the treehouse, resembling one of Annie's miniature replicas. The end. That's the end.
That's the end, guys.
So, this movie is kind of divided into three acts.
Yeah.
We already talked about where the second act ends. First act ends after Charlie dies.
Yeah. So, it kind of focuses on different characters.
Yes.
Each act. The first act is, obviously, Charlie.
Then it's Annie.
And then it's Peter.
Yeah. Peter's act is definitely the shortest.
And it kind of moves from character to character as Paimon moves.
From character to character. Yes. And something that's really interesting. So, I guess we need to start breaking down Paimon. Yeah. What he is, who he is, what
so,
he
does. So, Paimon is one of the eight gods of hell.
Yes.
He is typically shown riding a camel. He swears allegiance to Lucifer.
Uh-huh.
And, one second, there's a list of all of his powers that I have. I think that I have. So the symbol of Paimon is the one that Ellen is wearing around her neck.
Yes,
and the one that Annie wears around her neck. You see it on the post, on the telephone line.
Yes.
That Charlie gets her.
Decapitates
yeah.
herself on.
Yep. You see it a couple more times. You see it at the funeral a lot.
Yeah, it's on Joan's welcome mat.
Mm-hmm.
It's on her mom's welcome mat. It's on the wall.
And the book that Annie finds that's her mom's.
Yes, it's on there. It's on the wall above her corpse.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the treehouse at the end, but by then it's sort of like, we know.
Yeah, so that's the symbol of Paimon, and that's kind of what the cult identifies themselves as.
Yes, they worship him.
Yep, Ellen, Annie's mom, was the leader of this cult, Queen Lee.
Yes, so now time to break down some Paimon lore.
Yeah.
Sort of. Whether or not this is, some of this is real, some of this is made up. I'm not going to tell you which is which.
Yeah, I don't know either.
It's kind of all made up, isn't it? So
yeah. Paimon is a real god of hell, if you believe
in. If you believe in hell.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. So, there is, so basically, we talked about how we have to start back before Charlie's born to get this.
Yes.
Lee does a wedding ceremony. That's the picture of her in the dress
with the coins. Yes.
Okay, we assume that she does, this is some sort of like wedding ceremony to marry her to Paimon, making her the queen of hell, Queen Lee.
Queen Lee of hell, yeah.
She becomes Paimon's queen.
Yes.
On the earth. So now it's her job to bring back Paimon.
To get him a male host.
But essentially this makes her the most like prominent member of the cult. She's in charge.
She's Paimon's right-hand lady.
So she attempts to put Paimon into her child, her son,
mm-hmm.
who is Annie's brother. This does not work.
He kills himself.
It drives him crazy, and he kills himself. Leaving a note that blames Lee for trying to put people inside of him.
Mm-hmm.
They say he's schizophrenic. Also at this time, her father starves himself to death, probably to do with this.
Yeah, I'm guessing.
But we never know more about it.
We don't really know more. Annie becomes pregnant with Peter.
Yes. Lee wants to be involved, but Annie's husband, Steve, basically is like, cut her off. So they do. She's mm-hmm. not involved in Peter's raising. But by the time they have Charlie, so 3 years later,
yeah,
they say, okay, we'll let you be involved in Charlie. So here's where things start to become confusing.
Yes.
So Charlie is Paimon.
Charlie and Paimon are the same person.
They're not, she's not possessed by Paimon.
No.
She has grown up her whole life as Paimon.
Yeah, so Charlie and Paimon are inextricable.
Yes. Hard to say whether this happened in the womb. Hard to say whether it was directly after birth. But either way, if Charlie was ever a person, it was for such a small time that it basically never was real.
Yeah.
So this is why Lee is so obsessed with Charlie, why she, like, breastfed her.
Yeah, which we see in a miniature form.
Why she, like, wanted Charlie to be a boy. Why she and Charlie were so close, but she wasn't close to anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
This is all because Charlie is carrying Paimon. Now, here's the deal. Payman needs a male host. Charlie is not born a male.
Yeah.
So this becomes an issue. So essentially, from the very beginning, they know, the cult, Lee, know, that Charlie is a temporary host.
And that they need to move Charlie from this body to a male body.
Yes. Now, there's a little bit of a problem with this. Here's where we have to kind of, like, talk about who Charlie is as a character. So even though Charlie's Payman, Charlie doesn't really know that she's Payman.
Yes.
Payman, it's kind of like if Payman forgot that he was a king of hell.
Mm-hmm.
So Charlie has these, like, tendencies to do bad things.
Like decapitate little animals.
Yes. So Charlie has this, like, urge for chaos, and she's very quiet and reserved, and she struggles to get along with people. And she loves candy and sweets, which is generally, like, associated with sin. So she has all these, like, tendencies that kind of point to us that something's, like, wrong with her, right? Mm-hmm. But I think it's because Payman is in a female body, Payman can't really access his powers.
Agreed.
Fully.
Yeah.
Which is kind of the problem with him being in a female body. So this is why Charlie doesn't seem all that, like, evil, right? Like, Charlie seems weird and wrong.
But that's probably because she feels weird and wrong because she's not in the right body.
Exactly.
Payman is not in the right body.
So Charlie's a temporary vehicle. So that's when you know, that's why you start to notice that, like, everything that happens to Charlie is set up by the cult.
Yeah, so everything that kind of occurs, like the party, for instance, you can see in the background kids watching videos of decapitation.
Yes.
At the party, which is very odd. And I think that my theory is that the cult was somehow involved at the party.
Yeah. Now, I think it's possible that they might have been involved in a way that they used demonic spirits to do mm-hmm. certain things. It could be that they were really there making things happen.
Yeah.
It would be hard for them to be like, oh, Charlie's going to swerve now.
Mm-hmm.
Or Peter's going to swerve now, and Charlie will stick her head out the window. But it all fits together that these events happen, and the cult knows they're going to happen. So the cult places the deer on the road,
mm-hmm.
causing Peter to swerve to avoid the deer. And they, if you see, like, you can see that they carve their symbol on the telephone pole where Charlie will hit her head. And you see it on the way there.
Yes.
And you don't actually see it on the way back.
Yeah.
But you notice that there's no deer in the road before. And on his way back, there is.
Yes.
So that happens. Charlie's dead. But now Payman's spirit is just kind of floating around.
Kind of chilling around. And Joan, it becomes Joan's job to get to be friends with Annie.
Yeah.
So that she can teach her how to do a seance.
Yeah. So right now, Payman's spirit is kind of like nowhere.
Yeah.
It's around, but it can't really do anything.
Doesn't have a host or anything.
It doesn't have a host. So, Joan essentially teaches Annie this seance, in which she sort of attaches the spirit to an object.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is where I think the sketchbook comes in.
Yes.
So, she attaches it to an object. I really don't think the object matters at all.
No, I don't think so either. I think the spirit is just Payman.
I think so, too. So, they attach Payman to this book, which is now why I think the book cannot be burned.
Uh-huh.
Why it can't be destroyed. So, it's a way for Payman to communicate, right? As Charlie, who mm-hmm. he is. And this whole time, too, this is something that will come up later, but I think the spirit is still Charlie. And yeah. Payman, simultaneously. But I think Payman's malevolence is coming out.
I agree.
Because it seems like the spirit is still very confused.
Mm-hmm.
As Charlie would be.
Yeah, and even in the scene where Payman takes over Annie's body, he Charlie says, "Mom," she's crying out, "Mom, Mom, where are you?"
Yeah, she seems very confused. So, anyway, I think this is why the book can't be burned. Because the book is protected by Payman, by the cult, whatever.
Yeah.
And so then we got a flash forward, because now a bunch of stuff is happening with Payman, and we all think it's Charlie, we think it's a ghost movie. But then you'll see, like, after she burns the book, you'll see this, like, light kind of traveling through mm-hmm. the whole time.
If you've seen Donnie Darko, it's very similar to, like, the lit. Donnie Darko light.
It's the light from Donnie
Darko. It's the light from Donnie Darko. There's a scene in this movie that I'm like, that's a scene from Donnie Darko.
That's a shot-for-shot recreation of Donnie Darko. So, they basically, once she burns the book, this is, because here's the thing, you're kind of like, well, why doesn't Payman just possess Annie / Peter immediately? Mm-hmm. I think you have to be dead. Or so incredibly broken that your mind can be taken over by Payman.
Yeah.
I think Annie and Peter are both way too strong to be taken over by Payman. I think this is what initially failed with Lee's son.
Yeah.
I think they tried to get Payman to take over a healthy mind, and it rebelled, which is why he ended up killing himself. Mm-hmm. So you need to break the person.
You need to make them so vulnerable
that Payman can take over them.
Yeah.
It kind of plays into the fun little grief is a monster.
Yeah.
Biz that's happening, right? Mm-hmm. So, the moment when Annie is broken is when Steve gets killed. So this book thing takes care of two problems. Kill Steve, because we need him gone, because he's the person that keeps everyone really strong.
Yes.
So he's dead.
I love Steve.
And this completely breaks Annie. Like,
yeah, Annie, this was the one thing that was keeping her head above water.
And now it's gone. And she just did it. So, Payman can take over Annie. But again, he doesn't need a female host, and he needs Annie out of the way.
So, he needs to use Annie to get into Peter.
Peter. And he does. And Peter pretty much stays strong until the moment he jumps out the window and literally dies.
Oh my gosh, the scene whenever she chases him up from the... Okay, so can we just talk about the scene whenever he's in bed and he's getting up and she's in the floating in the goddamn corner.
So scary.
God! And then, like, she just floats around the top of the house. It's so scary.
It's horrifying. Also, the scene, they don't understand what's going on, and it's so sad.
No, whenever Peter, like, is like, Mommy, please stop. I'm sorry. He thinks that she's mad at him for killing Charlie.
Yeah, and it's not. It's just that we need your bod, buddy. Ugh. So anyway, after Charlie dies, the spirit's able to take over Charlie, able to possess him, or...
Peter.
Able to take over Peter, because he's dead.
Yes.
And now he's vulnerable. And so they take him over. And then when he goes up to the treehouse, This is why Joan refers to him as Charlie and has to explain to him what's going on.
Because Charlie thinks that she's just Charlie.
She
doesn't understand that she's Payman yet.
Yeah. But now that she's in a male host, she'll be able to unlock...
Her powers
to their fullest.
Yes.
And be able to fully realize herself. /himself/its.
Payman self.
So, that's kind of the that's what's going on in the movie.
Yeah.
Okay? This is, like, super hinted at through the whole film. But it seems so confusing because there's so many, like, subtle little signs that you don't notice, I think.
I agree. Especially rewatching the film, you see the cult everywhere.
Everywhere.
The cult is in the bereavement group.
Yep, they're at the funeral.
Everyone at the funeral is in the cult. Everyone in the support group is part of the cult.
His teachers is part of the cult. Also, this is something that's really interesting. So this movie kind of, I think this is very interesting, and this is not something that I've ever really seen talked about in interviews. Obviously this movie is a tragedy, right?
Yeah.
But it's a tragedy, like, Ari Aster already said that thing about how it's the sacrificial lambs watching themselves get sacrificed, right?
Yes.
So this is something that's interesting, and I kind of noticed because I have this, like, theater background. So tragedies, the reason tragedies exist, like, the true definition of a tragedy in the theatrical writing sense, is that it's something that is going to happen no matter what. And you cannot stop it. So you have people, usually you have like a hero or a protagonist, who has a tragic flaw. So in this case, it would be the family's grief. Is their tragic flaw. That they can't get over their grief.
They can't communicate.
Yeah, they can't communicate and they can't move on from these problems.
I think the dinner scene is the most, like, really
shows that.
That idea.
Yeah. So this is like, they have this like tragic flaw, which is that they cannot come together. And they can't get over this. So that causes them to make bad decisions. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, this was kind of fated from the start that it was going to happen. Everything that they do happens because it has to happen.
It's preordained.
It's preordained. And that's what's tragic about it, is that there's nothing they could do that would stop these events from happening. And so that's, like, the true definition of a tragedy, is something is preordained, it's going to happen, there's nothing you can do. Generally, the gods do it to you. In this case, the payment does it to you, and the cult, but whatever. But something that's really interesting, Peter is in class, and we know that his teachers are part of the cult, okay? Mm-hmm. And one of his teachers, it's a scene where Peter's just texting his friend about, like, hitting
smoking a bowl.
And he's looking at a girl who's really hot or something.
It's establishing that he's a stoner boy.
Yeah, yeah. But if you listen to what's going on in the background, okay? This is not what you're supposed to be listening to. But I listened to it because something caught my ear while I was watching Peter be ridiculous. And it was the word Iphigenia, or Iphigenia, or however you say it. I say Iphigenia, but some people say Iphigenia. Whatever. I don't know. It's Greek. I don't know. This person, I'm going to call it Iphigenia, she is a character in a Greek tragedy. So this is, there's this thing called the Oresteia. It's the only remaining set of three plays that we have from a complete tragedy. So the way the Greeks used to do plays is they would have three tragedies that all worked together. Mm-hmm. And then they would have a comedy, which would be played at the end, that would make fun of that set, that trilogy of tragedies.
Okay.
So the Oresteia is the only remaining complete set of the trilogy of tragedies that we have, that we know about. So the Oresteia basically follows the very first play, which I can't remember what it's called. It might be called, I'll look it up. I don't want to mess up. I don't want to give you guys false info. The Oresteia. If you ever want to read it, you can. It's free. Okay, the first one is called Agamemnon. Yes. I believe so. So, yeah, yeah. So, Agamemnon is the first one. And then it's something like the Libation Bearers. I think that's the last one. And the third one, it's called the Eumenides. So, essentially in this first one, what happens is this guy, Agamemnon, he's like a leader, like a war hero or something in Greece. And if you remember from Percy Jackson, there is a war going on, right? And Helen of Troy has been captured, and they're basically going to go, and they use her as an excuse to fight the other place that I can't remember what it is right now. But Troy, so this guy's from Troy, and he is going, and basically, they're getting ready to go sail for this pointless war that's literally about nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to win the war, even though it's about nothing, okay? But essentially, the tides are really bad. The wind's not in their favor. It's going to really hurt them. And so Agamemnon sacrifices his daughter, Iphigenia, to the gods in order to make the winds favorable over a pointless war. And it basically destroys his family because it does it, right? The winds mm-hmm. become favorable, but he's killed his wife, Clytemnestra's favorite daughter. And so she, while he's gone for 10 years fighting in this war, comes up with a plot to kill him. And when he gets back, she axe murders him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So all of this happens because he kills Iphigenia. So they're telling the story of Iphigenia and talking about how that is a tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a tragedy because she dies for nothing. And, of course, in the end, it causes him to die, which, of course, leads to this whole series of events that are impossible to stop. But this is, like, basically that story. Hereditary is, like, almost basically that story. Like, a husband dies because a daughter dies, and then a wife is killed by her son. Clytemnestra ends up being killed by her son, Orestes,
mm-hmm.
for killing her dad because it's an honor thing. But in the end, the son dies in this one, and the other one, the son doesn't die.
Yeah.
But that's sort of like, it's interesting that that's
what they chose to have going on in the background.
That's what they chose to have going on in the background. That's not a thing you learn in high school, for sure.
No, yeah.
You definitely learn that in your Theater History 1 class. Okay? And so it's really interesting that that would be the thing that they chose. A story that so accurately parallels what's happening here. And it's like, that's something I didn't notice until like the third watch.
Mm-hmm.
And
you're too busy focusing on how Peter's a stoner.
Exactly. I mean, you're focusing on the thing you're supposed to be focusing on. But it's like how there are so many people who probably never catch that. I've never seen it talked about in any of these like cool facts, things you missed videos.
Very interesting.
Because I just think it's such a small thing. Mm-hmm. But it's like, it just shows you how deep it all goes.
How prepared Ari Aster is.
Mm-hmm. Also, you'll notice, I'm sure you guys notice this, several times things are written on the walls. Words.
Yep.
Are written on the walls. And all of those words mean things. So I have it here. So the first thing we see is satiny, then liftoch, pandemonium, and zazas.
Zazas.
So it never explicitly says what those words mean, but satiny seems to be a word used in necromancy. Seems okay. to be a word that's often used in necromancy.
That would make sense.
Which is probably why it's written above Charlie's bed.
Yeah.
Liftoch is Hebrew for open. Pandemonium could be understood as its common definition, which is chaos. Mm-hmm. So open chaos. Or as the capital of hell and paradise lost. That's the capital of hell in that book. Is Liftoch Pandemonium.
Oh.
And Zazas seemingly refers to a demon who's frequently conjured by Ouija boards. So it's possible that the demon Zazas is helping them.
Yeah.
The whole time.
That would make sense.
While Paimon can't do things.
Mm-hmm.
Which could explain, like, if you think about that, maybe there's a whole other demon that's also helping them. Which kind of makes, in my opinion, the Paimon story fit better.
Yeah.
So, there you go. That's what those words mean.
Very interesting.
Very interesting. I'm just looking through my notes as well here. A lot of these are just about how good the acting is.
The acting is so good.
Or how good the set is, like, all the different colors.
Oh my gosh, the color stories are phenomenal.
Lots of sad things. Oh, also, very interesting, let's talk about the... What am I thinking? I wanted to talk about how many movies this is referencing.
Oh my gosh, yeah. So in there are a ton of shots that are like very Shining.
Yeah, oh
so
yeah, like, yeah, the fades.
The fades from like one character to another.
Following down the halls.
Yes, the slow pans around the corners. Yes. Obviously Donnie Darko, as we discussed, the light is straight out of Donnie Darko. Yeah, you can't tell me any different.
Rosemary's Baby.
Hail Paimon!
Hail Paimon! Also, she drinks that, like, witch's brew when she's at Jen's house. Which is just, like, a small little scene, but, like, clearly
it could just be, like, oh, you're paranoid, or it could be, like, oh, she's a witch. So, like, she doesn't know because it's paranoia.
The fire is Carrie.
Yes.
Some other things. I don't know. There's definitely some more in there.
Yeah, he said that, Rosemary's Baby was a huge, huge inspiration to him. He also... inspired by family dramas. Mm-hmm. So, like, Ordinary People, The Ice Storm in the Bedroom, and Don't Look Now, and The Innocents.
Yeah, he also talked about in the interview we watched, The Cook, The Thief, The Wife, and Her Lover, mm-hmm. which I have never seen, but honestly sounds so interesting.
Yeah, I haven't seen it either.
We're definitely gonna probably watch it. Some other little cute things that I saw. Cute. the time when Peter wakes up and he sees Charlie's apparition and her head turns into a ball.
Uh-huh.
3:03 a.m. is when he wakes up.
The witching hour.
Generally considered to be the witching hour. What else am I thinking? Oh, I said burning the book didn't kill Paimon. It freed him. it's also interesting as you, like, just the shots are so interesting. I don't even have time to talk about how technically beautiful it is.
I know, the lingering shots, you know, it's like, they stay on things just the right amount of time.
The sound design is so incredible.
Everything about it is just beautiful.
The score is so good. If I remember this, the score is, the person that designed the score was the person that Ari Aster listened to while writing the score.
Yes, that's what I heard, too.
So, incredibly interesting. Oh, also... very exorcist-y with the bugs.
Yes, very much so. They use a lot of very classic horror motifs.
Yes.
I like that, too, because it's not your, like, very classic horror. It's very, like, family drama type horror.
Yes.
So I really liked how they added in, like, the very classical things that they use. There's also a
shot.
Movies.
There's a shot in this movie. I believe it's Annie's walking down a hallway. It's to Joan's house, and the scene starts. The scene starts upside down, and then it turns right side up as she's walking. I know that is from a movie. I know they didn't invent that scene, that shot. I don't know who made it. I can't figure it out.
Let us know.
If you figure it out, please tell us, because that, it goes upside down and then turns right side up as she's walking, and I know it's from something. I've seen that shot. It's iconic. Yeah. I don't know what it is.
I don't either.
Also, just all these little, oh, the silent screams.
Yeah, very shining.
Very, sometimes, like, what's interesting, too, is so obviously the miniatures kind of reflect this idea that they are, like, miniatures, almost.
Yeah, and that everything that's happening outside of them is out of their control.
Control, right.
And, like, invisible hands are kind of modeling them to do what they want.
So something that's interesting, sometimes in the shots, they'll zoom in, and the first shot or two will still be the actors placed inside the model house. Mm-hmm. It won't be the real house that was built on the soundstage. It will still be the model.
Yeah.
For, like, a bit. So when they first start, it'll be like, that's the actual, they're inside the model. It's very interesting, because it's so subtle that it almost makes you go, like, are they in the model?
Yeah, exactly. Are they real? Are they even real? Is this even really happening? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the whole, I really like how all the models really show you the important events that happen in Annie's life,
mm-hmm.
but I'm just so confused about the preschool.
I know, I don't.
What happened in the preschool?
I don't know. I feel like it must have been some event with Charlie.
That's what I'm,
perhaps Charlie hurt someone or did something. It never is explained. I've never seen anyone question it, though.
No, no, because, so, they talk about how, like, there's the hospice miniature, there's, like, the bed miniature where she's breastfeeding Charlie, there's the crash miniature, and then there's this preschool miniature, we never figure out what happened in the preschool.
Yes. Let's see. Does anyone have any idea of its relevance? I'm looking at Reddit here.
Okay.
Apparently it's never said.
Yeah, I from what I've seen, it's never been addressed.
She said it could just be a memory, a positive memory. It could be anything that it's never addressed.
Hmm.
And they said they've never seen it talked about in any interview. It's also other stuff, too, like she spills blue paint at some point, and it's the exact shade of blue of Charlie's coffin.
Yeah.
And I'm like, is that symbol? It's almost like, is there so much stuff in it that I'm like, is that a big deal?
Yeah, exactly, because you don't know.
But at the same time, it's like, it gets you to a point where you, again, this is a very Rosemary's Baby feeling, which we talked about in our Rosemary's Baby episode, too, if you want to listen to that, where we talked about this idea of, you feel like you're going crazy. Because you start to look for these tiny little things like blue paint. That's probably nothing.
Exactly, but you look for these symbols.
Exactly. It's like, does the blue mean things? Also, there's a scene where Steve comes in the house. It's after Annie has destroyed her entire studio.
Oh, that's an intense scene.
And he comes in and he says, what's that smell?
Yeah, and it's never addressed.
It's never addressed. Again.
Is it paint thinner?
Is it paint thinner? Exactly. That's what I'm thinking.
Is she going to burn down the... Oh, she going to
burn down the house?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's all these sort of things. Very freaky.
Yeah.
Very freaky.
Also, how they make a huge deal about taking their shoes off in the house.
Yes. Yeah.
Shoes and socks.
Yeah. And another thing we talk about, which we learned in the deleted scenes, which is that Steve was Annie's psychiatrist.
After her brother died.
And now they're married. Which I like Steve.
I like Steve a lot. I think Steve's a really good character. I think he's a really good husband.
But learning that gave me kind of a weird feeling.
Yes, me too. It's very weird. That's not okay, guys. Don't do that.
Yeah.
Please. Don't ever date your psychologist.
Yeah. Also, just a fun thing that happened in the idea of whenever they're doing interviews with all the actors, and Alex Wolff was talking about he went method for this role.
Yeah, he went method acting for this role.
Did not go well. I mean, he did great.
He obviously did a great job, obviously, yeah.
But he said it, this is a little quote. He said, "I didn't think about what it could do to your psyche or whatever."
And he had to go to therapy for like 6 months.
Yeah, he had PTSD. He says he straight up says he doesn't remember filming some of the shots at all.
Yeah, he actually dislocated his jaw during the scene where he slams mm-hmm. his head down. Mm-hmm. He wanted to break his nose, but Ari Aster was like, no, no, no.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then he made the desk like have a cushion on it, but mm-hmm. he still managed to break his to jaw. Dislocate his jaw
from a previous injury, but still.
Yeah.
So let me see if I can read some of these interesting facts slash things.
I have one.
Okay.
Ari Aster requested that Alex Wolff and Millie Shapiro go out to eat in character a few times, and they would sit up there for 3 hours in silence while Millie wouldn't speak and Alex would try to get her to talk.
Pretty real. So this is from, I believe, either a BuzzFeed or perhaps Vulture article, where it's talking about what's going on, but this is just a fun little quote. But they're talking about the scrap. They're talking about how this movie makes you paranoid, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
The scrapbook photos of Ellen wearing a white dress and a veil as if she's being showered with gold coins. That sure looks like a wedding ritual once you see her framed portrait in the satanic treehouse, which has a placard named Queen Lee fixed to the top. Does that mean Grandma was spiritually married to her granddaughter and therefore breastfed her husband grandchild when she was an infant? Sure seems like it.
That's a Vulture article.
I know. So, like, we talked about the book protecting itself.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Why was Annie sleepwalking then? So go with us on this one. Again, this is the Vulture BuzzFeed article. What if the sleepwalking was Annie's subconscious way of fighting her mother and the ritual? We mm-hmm. talked about this before.
Yes.
But this is just going to say what we said in our old episode, which is now gone, so we can't prove that, but we did talk about this. We do know about this. She tried to set Peter and Charlie on fire once before, but snapped out of it, right? And then in the dream, we see where she admits she wants to abort Peter, but her mom wouldn't allow it. And so she tried to force a miscarriage.
Mm-hmm.
She screams at him, "I wasn't trying to kill you. I was trying to protect you." Also, at this same time, this is when Peter and her both become drenched in paint thinner.
Yeah.
And somewhere in Annie's subconscious, she must have known her children were in danger, and just as her brother had tried to kill himself, or had killed himself, to escape Ellen's clutches when he was a teenager, Annie must have known deep down that as long as her kids were alive, they were existentially threatened.
I think that would really add up, because also it could go into Annie's dad starving himself.
Exactly.
And all these family members subconsciously knowing something is wrong mm-hmm. and trying to stop it by ending their own lives.
Right. And like I said, it explains the paint thinner thing, and it explains the dream.
Mm-hmm.
It explains why she has such an odd relationship with her children. Because she thinks, like, I mean, they're putting her in danger, right?
Yeah.
So, let's talk about this. Okay. I'm trying to find all this stuff and talk. See, I took so many screenshots of things. I'm trying to be like, did we already talk about that? Okay, so here's the thing, too. Ari Aster says that he feels the film suggests that Ellen only had kids for the purposes of these rituals
mm-hmm.
to have things. But why then does Ellen make such a fuss over her son and her grandson when there's another healthy male body, her son-in-law's, right there? So the title is the clue.
Yep.
It's hereditary.
It's hereditary. It has to be within the family.
Steve is not related to Ellen by blood and therefore is unsuitable in some way for the payment transfer. As well as her husband. That's why she didn't just do it to her husband, right? Mm-hmm. To Annie, Steve, and Peter, the events detailed in Hereditary seem not just unforeseeable, but completely unthinkable. In actuality, Aster said, "This is absolutely inevitable. The family has absolutely no agency. Any control they try to seize is hopeless. This helplessness extends to their apparent screw-ups. Annie's decision to cast the spell may move the cult's plans forward, but it would have happened anyway," says mm-hmm. Aster. "We're seeing one of the ways it could play out. In other words, even if she'd avoided the trap, her fate would have caught up with her in some way. As Ari Aster see it, Hereditary is a story about the long-lived possession ritual lamb told from the perspective of the sacrificial lamb. The Grahams are props in a scheme they cannot grasp, set into motion years ago by forces outside their comprehension. which sounds dark at first, but in fact just makes them like us. After all, we too are products of families we didn't choose, genes we didn't select, histories we don't know, and circumstances we can't control.
Mm-hmm.
All we can do is hope our grandmothers haven't promised our bodies to as vessels for demon kings. So that's, again, that's like why Steve can't be a part of it. Mm-hmm. It's why nobody else can be a part of it, because they have to be related to Ellen, since Ellen is married to Payman. Right. Yes. So that's the deal.
The dealio.
The dealio. I also have very interesting facts. I think this movie is very interesting.
It is very interesting.
So let's see. This is fun. So one of the trailers for Hereditary was accidentally shown at the beginning of a PG-rated family-friendly film, Peter Rabbit, in Australia. It caused a small panic in the theater, with parents fleeing the cinema with their children.
That's very funny.
The theater eventually shut the screen off and offered every audience member a complimentary movie pass to apologize for the mistake. The original cut of this film could have easily pushed over 3 hours.
Naturally,
but most of it was cut out. It was a lot of family dialogue, like we said, those scenes.
There's a lot of Peter scenes.
A lot of Peter scenes, a lot of Steve scenes.
And I think it took away from the kind of having no main character that the movie kind of has now.
Yeah.
I think that it would have made Peter more the main character.
Yeah, it also, in my opinion, kind of makes, it either makes Annie or Peter seem way too at fault.
Yeah, I agree.
Because the way it is now, it's kind of like it's no one's fault. It was an accident.
It just happened.
It just happened. Everything conspired to make it happen. Okay, so, to make the chalkboard write on itself during the seance with Joan, the special effects team, this was actually done practically.
Oh, he loves practical effects.
Yeah, it's not CGI. The special effects team put a magnet in the chalk and put a magnet on the other side of the chalkboard to make the chalk move. It was very difficult to get a small magnet inside the chalk and make it write smoothly. So that was actually a practical effect. The producer said that it worked out well that Gabriel Byrne and Alex Wolff had worked together, and that Alex and Millie Shapiro knew each other from school.
Yeah.
They'd gone to school together. I mean, she's considerably younger than him, but still. Because it made Toni Collette the outsider, which mirrored Annie's character and feelings of alienation with her own family.
Yeah.
This film was shot in 32 days.
Wow.
I know. Insane. So there is a director cameo in the film at about 1 hour, 23 minutes. That voice on the phone calling Annie about her exhibit is Ari Aster.
He is so unassuming looking.
I know. He doesn't seem the kind of guy that makes this movie.
No.
Let's see what else. Ari Aster has 10 screenplays he has written that he hopes to direct over the course of his career.
Good.
I know.
I hope there's more horror.
Here we go. This is at 14 minutes in the movie. About 14 minutes. In Peter's first scene at the school, the words "escaping fate" is written on the chalkboard with the teacher discussing it.
Mm.
This is the same place with the Iphigenia.
Okay.
This is a reference to Halloween 1978, where the main character discusses the exact same thing in class. Appropriately, this movie was released the same day as the trailer for Halloween 2018.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's probably more of an accent, but still cool. I think it's still cool. Let's see if I got anything else. We already talked about the chocolate. We already talked about the symbol. Oh, not only is this a horror motif, but in art history, ants are symbolic of death.
Yeah.
And also, the scene where the pigeon hits the window.
Yes.
Pigeons are used as messengers who sometimes carry warnings. So that's why.
And that happens very early in the film.
Yeah, so that's why he's there. Now, Allison's gonna try to pull up a review, but IMDb has been crashed for the last couple days. and it, for some reason, won't let me pull up reviews for things, although it let me pull up literally anything else. So, let's see if it works, and if not, I'm gonna read the first review on Google, which is bad, but also probably not nearly as funny. Nope, not gonna work. Let's see. Hereditary reviews, Google. I already kind of looked these up, but there aren't as many good ones on Google, unfortunately.
Yeah, IMDb has all the best reviews.
Yeah. Okay, so this is from... I can't say this name. I don't know what it is. Some person on Google. It's the first one that if you Google hereditary reviews. Most of these are actually really good. This one is bad. Here we go. Thank God I didn't pay for it. Hereditary is a movie that did not need to be made. Of course, no movie ever needs to be made, but Hereditary is a movie that really did not need to be made. More so than other movies that have been made. It is a partial... Yeah, I know. It's already really good. I think. It is a partial mix of Rosemary's Baby with maybe Mother or other movies that were made but did not need to be made.
Mother? Really? You see Mother in this? I don't see Mother in this at all.
It has a mother. And it is scary, so I guess that's it. It is unclear what Hereditary is about. The genre fit it claims is drama, horror, and mystery. However, one could also imagine it as a failed black comedy, because the audience who watched it with me laughed loudly at either all the wrong times or all the right times. If they laughed at the right times, is it failed?
Is it... what?
I don't know. It is a fine line to entertain with intent or by happenstance, because the outcomes are the same. The problem with Hereditary is that it does not move any needle in any perceivable direction, and it is hardly dramatic, horrifying, or mysterious. The build-up to this film, the trailers, publicity, advanced reviews, had all led me to believe I was going to the cinema to see the best horror film of 2018. Potentially something in the same league as The Exorcist or The Shining. I agree that it is in those leagues.
I also agree.
But Hereditary doesn't deliver the goods. Toni Collette and Gabriel Byrne deliver credible performances, but sadly they are let down by the weakness of the storytelling, which never rises above the trite and obvious. Obvious!
You what?
Obvious!
Are you saying that you could tell what was going to happen?
Or did you just not get it at all? That seems more likely. In fact, this film is such a maladroit... M-A-L-A-D-R-O-I-T.
Maladromat?
No M.
No M?
It's right here, somewhere.
Maladroit, I guess?
Maladroit. I don't know that word. Mashup of established horror tropes, I could be convinced the plot was generated by a computer. I experienced a couple of mild jump scares and was grossed out a few times. What I like about this movie is that there's literally no jump scares. Like, at all.
There's one where she starts running at him whenever they're in the living room.
But, and that's it.
And that's it.
And also, you can see her.
And that's just not like a jump... That's just... Oh my god, I'm
also,
scared.
Also, you can see her.
Yeah.
They never hide her.
No.
She just starts running at him all of a sudden. Let me see. But overall, this film not only failed to inspire a sense of horror in me, it also failed to attain the suspension of disbelief that is a prerequisite to genuine horror. Some scenes and effects are so poorly executed, they are actually laugh-out-loud funny rather than scary. The only thing I can really think of that looks kind of bad is when she's floating.
Yeah, but...
That doesn't look great.
But
it looks fine.
I mean, it's so dark.
Yeah, and also, I don't remember it. Like, I remember in the theater it looking really good. On the TV, maybe it looks a little worse.
Yeah, I don't know. I was so scared I didn't even care what it looked like.
I know. I cannot account for the praise that has been lavished on this film, or for the high ratings that it currently has on social media sites, except to suppose that the studio had paid a small army of online sock puppets to generate hype. I expect this will be corrected in coming weeks as more and more disappointed filmgoers make their feelings known. I expected a film comparable to The Woman in Black or even... Keep going. Don't worry. He compares it to more films.
Oh, man.
Or even Winchester or The Grudge.
Ooh.
Ooh, The Grudge.
The Grudge.
That movie I loved when I was 12. But instead, it was an exercise in how different people deal with tragic death in their lives. What a horrible thing to explore in film.
So not interesting.
Not scary at all. To me, it was disturbing. I wanted to be entertained with scary ghost house doings, but the tragedy of the events in Toni Collette's character's life left me with a sense of dread and sadness.
Yeah.
The person is just describing what the movie actually wanted him to feel, and he's like, but I didn't
want to be sad.
I want to be scared. I want to see The Nun.
It's no Woman in Black.
It's no Woman in Black. Truly. It's no Groundhog Day. I just really... Oh, that's not good. That joke is not going to read to when we replace the first episode. Sorry, people who are listening to the first episode. The Groundhog Day thing comes later.
Yeah, that's a Patreon bit.
Oh, yeah. You'll never see it. Yeah, so this person's literally just describing what they wanted them to see. Oh, no. What happened? Oh, there it is.
That like, where's my thing? Is so...
They're still...
No.
Yeah, there's still more. I just accidentally lost my place. Okay. Initially expecting spooky scares, what was really scary was watching her character slowly dissolve into insanity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is what's scary, isn't it? That is what's scary.
That's the point! Maybe this was a good review. I was looking for something the film did not deliver. I went to see the film based on reviews of people who had seen the film and the star ratings given by publication like The Empire and Total Film. The first hour, nothing much happened. I thought setting things up for the second hour when things would take off. Wrong. The second hour was as boring as the first. The film boils down to a witch's coven trying to give life a demon in a human host. No. It does not.
Nope.
It's so bad in parts that the audience, including me, were sniggering. See it done better than this film. Toni Collette I thought was good, which is the only reason it got 2 stars. Apart from her, the rest of the cast... By the way, this is 2 out of 5. Apart from her, the rest of the cast, including Gabriel Byrne, was completely forgettable. I can't believe Empire Magazine, which I place a great deal of reliance to, provided a rating which truly reflects how good slash bad this film is, got it so wrong for this film. What is the big deal? It could be an artist's interpretation of a family who regularly takes too much Ambien or NyQuil. If that's the case, Hereditary might be the most important movie ever made, in addition to being a subtle suggestion that it is never too early to consider emancipation from your parents, and it is never too early to spray the attic for insects and other pests. No story at all, not even worth watching if you get a free ticket. 2 to 3 scenes are only good. Avoid it, total waste of time. 2 out of 10.
Well... It's No Woman in Black.
No Woman in Black. Also, they literally were like, this was not good. Horrible. Bad stuff. And they said, but the acting was really good, and it was really disturbing and sad, and it really got to you, but also not scary at all.
Not good. Did not do what it was supposed to do.
Yeah, didn't... Just made me sad and disturbed. Didn't at all scare me. And you're like, well, that was the point.
What would you give this movie, Allison?
A 10 out of 10. It's my favorite movie.
Me, too. 10 out of 10. So good.
Love this movie. Favorite horror movie.
It's so unpleasant to watch. It's so good, though.
Literally ruins my day when I have to watch it. It's so sad. But, you know.
It's great.
Don't let that deter you.
No, it's amazing, you guys.
So good. All right.
All right, guys. Thank you for listening.
Bye.
Bye.